From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Florida lawmakers will come to Tallahassee on Monday for a special session.
Monday's special session is a great opportunity for the members of the Florida legislature to basically just put their money where their mouth is.
Also this week, Governor DeSantis wants the federal government to turn over its Everglades restoration program to the state of Florida.
Lord knows we'll do it a hell of a lot quicker than they will do it.
We'll also dig out from the combination of snow and sleet that hit the northern part of Florida this week, and we'll contemplate some of the political maneuverings that are taking place among those in Florida's minority political party. I'm Tom Flanagan. Online and on air, this is Capitol Report and your end-of-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. Florida's legislative leaders have officially made the call. The State House and Senate are scheduled to meet in special session at 10:30 this coming Monday morning. However, as Lynn Hatter reports, it remains unclear whether the governor will get all of the immigration and ballot reform changes he's calling for at this time.
The DeSantis administration has unveiled several proposals it wants state lawmakers to approve in a special session. The ideas have two main themes, immigration and citizen ballot initiative changes. DeSantis wants the state to get a jump start on enforcing President Donald Trump's immigration crackdown. He reiterated that during a press conference days ago in Jacksonville.
Clearly, this immigration stuff, there's a mandate from the voters. They want this dealt with. They are sick of having lawlessness reigns supreme in this country when it comes to who comes in our country. That is not for foreigners to decide. It's for us to decide as Americans through the normal political process and in the laws we choose to enact through our elected representatives.
Among the ideas DeSantis has floated, ending in-state tuition subsidies for undocumented immigrants and giving local law enforcement more power to enforce and execute immigration laws. DeSantis also wants further restrictions on how citizen-led constitutional proposals can be validated. The two most recent, one that would have legalized recreational marijuana use and another that would have lifted the state's current 6-week abortion limits, both failed narrowly last year. The governor opposed both. Under his plans, campaigns would no longer be able to use petition gatherers, and signatures would have to be collected at local supervisor of elections offices or by requesting a petition through the mail. And the state would have greater authority to reject ballot initiatives. The heavy focus on immigration, though, has riled advocates like Tallahassee-based attorney Elizabeth Ritchie. Ritchie's law office is a frequent supporter of WFSU.
I don't think anybody who is reasonable is saying we don't need immigration reform. People are saying this is not the way to do it. It's not for states to do. They don't have the authority. Let the federal government do what they should be doing. And in the meantime, states like Florida should be attending to the needs of everyday Floridians with things that they have authority to control and to improve.
Democratic Senate leader Jason Pizzo is also critical of a plan that would strip undocumented students of in-state tuition. He spoke with reporters in Tallahassee Friday.
You know, the governor keeps hammering on that. The other day he's like, and we have this 10-year-old relic of, I don't know how it passed or what people were thinking. And I'm like, did someone remind him that it was Lieutenant Governor that carried that bill, that his ag commissioner voted for it, that the CFO voted for it, I don't know.
The bill that granted in-state tuition was sponsored by Lieutenant Governor Jeanette Nunez when she was still a state representative. Pizzo does say he's okay with complying with federal immigration law, but says the state itself handling deportations does not make sense to him. While most of the measures appear to be ideologically aligned with the state's governing Republican majority, the leaders of the state House and Senate, the bodies charged with approving any bills related to the policies the governor wants, initially said they would not go along with a special session and called it, quote, premature. In Jacksonville, DeSantis pushed back on that.
Monday's special session is a great opportunity for the members of the Florida legislature to basically just put their money where their mouth is. Everyone has been complaining about Biden for 4 years. Now we have a new sheriff in town. Now we have an opportunity to make a difference.
Whether the governor gets his full wish list will be up to lawmakers to decide in the coming days. I'm Lynn Hatter.
And here's a bit of breaking news that connects directly to Lynn's story. The Florida Department of Law Enforcement late this afternoon announced a person they described as a non-citizen had been arrested on charges of voter fraud. There were no surprises at first when Governor Ron DeSantis said his proposed state budget for the next fiscal year includes more money for Everglades restoration. But what he said later shocked many, and his words are still reverberating through the state's environmentalists as we hear from WGCU's Tom Bayless.
There was no reason to believe a stop in Juneau Beach earlier this month to discuss his budget proposal would be anything other than routine. Then DeSantis said it. He would be asking now President Donald Trump to give Florida the federal portion of the restoration money, wrest from the Army Corps the main decision-making power, and give it to him since, he says, the state is doing all the work.
Our view is like, we got the job to do. We want to get it done. We don't want to be bogged down by red tape. We don't want to be bogged down by bureaucracy. Once we make the decision that this is something in the interest of the state, we want to get it done as quickly as possible. That is not how some federal agencies like the Army Corps of Engineers approach things. But I mean, I would not want to be known as the one part of government that's the slowest, right?
DeSantis claims Florida has been doing the lion's share of the work, so he will be asking the funding to be given to the state.
And we will manage these projects, and we will execute these projects on behalf of the federal government, because Lord knows we'll do it a hell of a lot quicker than they will do it.
DeSantis then struck a pro-development tone when he shifted to recounting how a federal judge last year took away Florida's permission to issue certain building permits, some of which would have allowed subdivisions with thousands of new homes and miles of new roads in the heart of the western Everglades panther country. The governor laid the blame for that loss with the Biden administration, but federal district judge Randolph Moss made the decision after considering multiple lawsuits about the panther and other endangered species in the western Everglades that had been in litigation since before Biden's presidency. Tanya Galone, the managing attorney for Florida for Earth Justice, an environmental nonprofit and leading opponent of the residential developments, said DeSantis's logic is just politics.
Florida's governor can make any political statements he wants, but the fact is that Florida's ecosystems, including the Everglades, are in trouble. All you have to do is look around to see that the state is failing to protect our waterways from pollution and failing to safeguard the plants and animals that rely on Florida's wetlands and waters. We need to strengthen environmental protections, not continue to let development run rampant.
Galone said with the state of Florida totally in charge under DeSantis, development could run rampant and environmental safeguards could weaken. It was at another community press conference, this one 5 months ago in Winter Haven, when DeSantis shelved those wildly unpopular plans to develop state parks with golf courses and luxury hotels, while his Department of Environmental Protection would be, quote, going back to the drawing board, unquote, with potential reconsideration next year. In Fort Myers, I'm Tom Bayless.
Coming up on Capitol Report, it wasn't exactly a winter wonderland, but a big chunk of North Florida was hit this week by a mix of snow and sleet. Although weather experts point out this isn't the first time.
We've gotten snow before, we've gotten ice before. Even in Central Florida in the 70s and 80s, there have been reports of snowfall.
And one of those who worked most closely with President Jimmy Carter has memories and stories that didn't get much coverage during the former president's funeral earlier this month.
He insisted that the famous Hail to the Chief not be played when he entered a room in the White House.
From the panhandle down into parts of Central Florida, a rare winter storm dumped freezing rain and even snow this week. Gina Jordan spoke with Florida Public Radio Emergency Network meteorologist Megan Borowski to try to figure out what happened and if it can happen again.
Do we need to invest in ice scrapers? Is this going to be more prevalent for us, do you think?
Well, that's going to be a question for a climatologist of what is, you know, over the next decades, what we're looking at in terms of changes in winter weather. I think the fact that, in panhandle locations, we've gotten snow before, we've gotten ice before. Even in Central Florida in the 70s and 80s, there have been reports of snowfall. Do you need to get the full-blown winter, you know, winterization of your car and tire chains and things like that? No, I don't think so. But I do think it's worth investing in maybe an ice scraper for frost that might be on your windshield in the morning. Just little things that can help make your life easier, even if that's just getting a better winter coat or making sure you have some insulated and waterproof gloves.
Well, I'll ask you now, what is the long-range forecast for the rest of this winter?
Looks like the Climate Prediction Center issued their forecast for February, March, and April. So the end of winter and the beginning of spring. And right now it looks like there's a 60 to 65% chance that temperatures will actually trend above normal for a good portion of the state. And precipitation trends will be just a little bit below normal. You know, we've seen so far this winter relatively dry conditions. You know, we just had a big weather event where we did get some precipitation from that. But overall, it has been dry. So I'm not surprised that we see that continuing. And also, we have had cold snaps like the one that we're currently dealing with here in the Panhandle and in North Central Florida as well. But relatively, this winter has been somewhat on the milder side. I'll be interested to see where we rank in terms of temperatures once the winter is over. But at least, you know, for the next 3 months, so January is almost done. So February, March into April, we're looking at above average temperatures and below average precipitation. How that actually fleshes out remains to be seen. There is the potential still that with that above average temperature, below average rainfall, there is still the chance that we get one or two more cold snaps. You know, that forecast is for the months on whole. It doesn't take into account particular events. So we'll see what happens. We still have, I would say, you know, through the middle to end of February is really the sweet spot to get these cold snaps and winter storms. So we'll see if Mother Nature has one more left. Hopefully not, but we'll be tracking it.
Okay. Megan, is there anything else you'd like to share?
The main thing is now that the event is over, still, you know, be extra careful on the roads. We are expecting ice each morning. I can't stress that enough. Now that the flakes aren't falling anymore, everybody thinks, okay, we're good to go. Well, no, black ice is a scary thing. You don't want to be caught losing control of your car. So just be careful driving the next few mornings.
The winter weather that recently covered much of North Florida in a blanket of white gave many Sunshine State residents an unexpected chance to try out some of winter's most quintessential pastimes, from snowball fights to snowman building to sledding. WFSU's Regan McCarthy takes us to Cascades Park, where she joined in the fun.
When winter weather hits in a town where snow gear is hard to come by, a bit of creativity is required.
We came outside with a laundry basket, a lid bin, a clear bin, and an inflatable.
These were all like random things that we had in our closets.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was trial by error.
That's Jillian Schiller and her friend Sarah Gibson. The inflatable tube popped, but both agree when it comes to picking a makeshift sled, the laundry basket is the way to go. Especially once you get the technique down.
Get a good strong front to give you a little push.
Yes.
Yeah.
Legs,
you're good
out
to go.
For a slowing mechanism.
Arms up. Yeah.
And Gibson says she has one more piece of advice.
I would say, like, if you want to go really fast, wear a helmet. Because people
are
taking tumbles
out,
for sure.
Across the hill, Alex O'Connell agrees. In fact, she's wearing a bike helmet right now.
Yeah, I'm a safety nerd, so I grabbed it before we left the house.
O'Connell says she's glad she's wearing it. Her sled of choice is also a laundry basket, and she says it can feel a little scary when it starts going fast.
Mostly when I'm backwards and I can't see where I'm going and like when to stop, but it's really fun, so
yeah,
totally worth it.
Totally worth it is the same sentiment shared by Jenna Palladino, who drove from Tampa when she heard the North Florida forecast call for snow.
Yes, when we were on I-10, it was just a little dusting coming, and then all of a sudden the rain, and we thought, oh no, we made the wrong choice, we've got to go north. And then overnight, we could hear it hitting the hotel windows.
Palladino says her young sons and nephew have been sledding for hours, making the experience well worth the drive.
I don't know if I can get them off this hill, so I would say theirs is probably a 10 out of 10.
Schiller and Gibson agree.
10 yeah. out of 10. Yeah. We would do it every day. That was awesome.
That was really fun.
It was awesome. Very liberating. Very one of a kind. It was a great experience.
And with reviews like that, how could I pass up the opportunity to give it all a try?
Oh yeah, here we go.
I'm Regan McCarthy in Tallahassee.
On the most recent episode of the Deeper Dive with Derek Kam podcast from the News Service of Florida, Florida House Minority Leader Fentress Driscoll talked about what keeps her motivated in a state dominated by Republicans. Here's an excerpt.
We worked very hard. I'm so proud of my members and the candidates that we had in our program. Everyone worked very hard, despite record-breaking fundraising, despite having candidates in our targeted seats who overperformed the top of the ticket. It just wasn't enough to get us across the finish line and flip the 5 seats necessary to end the Republican supermajority, which honestly has been bad for government. So we had a lot of buy-in to the program, which I really appreciate. But when you're so far down ballot as a state house race, it's pretty tough to carry all of that weight on your shoulders. And so, you know, in a Trump plus 14 environment, which right. is what we were in Florida,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it's so highly unlikely that far down ballot you'll be able to.
You're really swimming upstream.
Yeah. But what I will tell you is that across the country, many Democratic caucuses and state legislatures lost seats.
Yeah.
And we actually came back with the same number that we started with at the end of the 22 cycle. We started with 22.
Okay.
We came back with 22. That's my silver lining. Now, we do have a couple of former members who left the caucus. And the way that I view that, I mean, these are two members who ran as Democrats, right? Like just this shy of 90, the other side of 90 days ago. Like, I don't even think it's been 90 days
right.
since the election.
A month after the election.
That's right. And so I guess if these members believed so strongly in the things that they said in their statements explaining their departures, if they believe so strongly in that, then wouldn't they have run as Republicans?
Is it transactional?
You know, I don't know what's in anybody's hearts or their intention. You'll be surprised to learn that they don't quite consult the Democratic leader when they're about to defect and leave the party. But I would say, you know, watch their votes.
Mm-hmm.
I would say watch what they run for next. I think that will tell us a lot about their intentions and who they are. I think more than anything, it's such a disappointment and betrayal to the voters. Like the folks who just elected them in as Democrats.
Unopposed, I think.
One was unopposed.
Yeah.
Yeah, one was unopposed. Yeah. And so I don't know how somebody does that to the voters.
As leader, do you feel like there's a hemorrhaging taking place? Do you feel like these were outliers? Or do you think there's something that you need to do to try to help keep your people in the caucus?
I mean,
it's not really usual for this to happen. Especially not this close to an election.
It does strike me as strange as well, but I don't know what else we could do if people are inclined to leave. And so I did talk to some former leaders, like trying to have historical mm-hmm. perspective and just people who have been in the process for longer. And the perspective that they gave me is that we're starting to see the culmination of all of these years of gerrymandering and Democrats getting pushed deeper and deeper into the minority. In that it's not even so much about this particular cycle as it is like this is just really difficult headwinds for Democrats to overcome in Florida. And so maybe people are reading those tea leaves and making decisions for whatever they think they should do for their future, including abandoning the party. But at the same time, you know, I look at it and I think we're in the minority, but I also see opportunity. Because when I talk to people in the community, they're so fed up. They're so freaking fed up at their property insurance rates and that housing affordability is so difficult to find and healthcare and everything's getting more expensive.
That was Florida House Minority Leader Fentress Driscoll on the Deeper Dive with Derek Kam podcast, a product of the News Service of Florida. Hear the full episode wherever you get your podcasts. The Florida Democratic Party's having elections for who will lead their party tomorrow in Orlando. Tristan Wood reports it comes at a time of tremendous turbulence for the party.
Democrats are licking their wounds after their worst presidential election performance in the state since 1988. Republicans claimed outright supermajorities in both state legislative chambers. They lost two additional seats when sitting Democrats switched parties. After those results, incumbent FDP Chair Nikki Fried is being challenged by former Jacksonville state lawmaker Audrey Gibson, who says her party needs a complete makeover.
It's not Lawton Childs' Democratic Party anymore. It's 2025. We have to meet people where they are. The demographics of the party has changed. The makeup of who's part of the party has changed, or the people that we're trying to keep and bring back at this point.
Fried became the party chair in 2022 after the party had a terrible performance in the midterm. In a video posted across her social media accounts, Fried says rebuilding is going to take time.
Our mission is bigger than one election. Our journey to rebuild will continue for many elections to come. And consistency is key. Stability is key. As we continue to rebuild, the path forward will remain simple. We continue to organize in our communities, work to earn the support of voters in local elections, and register voters year round.
The chair position isn't the only one up for grabs. Two people are running for vice chair: Duval County Democratic Party head Daniel Henry and 20-year-old political organizer Jaden D'Onofrio. Duval has been one of the few bright spots for Democrats in Florida, with the party winning the Jacksonville mayor race in 2023. Henry says he wants to bring some of that success to the state party.
That we're showing Democrats in cities and communities across the state what it means to be a Democrat and what it means in terms of providing everyday voters and neighbors a better life and a better shared experience. That is the way that I think we're going to be able to truly get to a point where Democrats run statewide and we can be successful.
Meanwhile, D'Onofrio ran a political committee this past election cycle that raised over $1 million.
Republicans have dominated our legislature for every year since 1996 and our governor's mansion for every year since 1999. It's gotten us to this point where we have one of the worst property insurance crises in the entire country, and we're also one of the most unaffordable states in the entire nation. And unfortunately, on a larger scale, I don't think our state party was able to bring that message to the voters.
This is also the first FDP election under new party rules. Those changes are giving more Democrats who may not be aligned with the mainstream wing of the party greater say. Here's FDP spokesman Matt Daly.
Ending the weighted vote means that we have elected more state committee people per county. So now Miami-Dade County and many others have a number of state committee people who will vote for the chair. And so what that means is there are more voices at the table than we've ever had before for an election.
Regardless of the outcome of Saturday's election, the Republican Party's dominance in Florida is unlikely to be upturned anytime soon. Democrats have a long way to go if they want to regain any power and influence in state government. I'm Tristan Wood.
You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, as Donald Trump reclaimed the presidency, there were more than a few people who were still recalling their encounters with one of his predecessors, Jimmy Carter. Ambassador Stuart Eisenstadt first met Jimmy Carter when he was running for governor of Georgia in 1970, and he served as Carter's chief domestic policy advisor during his time in the White House. He also delivered a eulogy at President Carter's funeral on January 9th. WGCU's Mike Canary talked with Ambassador Eisenstadt about working with Jimmy Carter and his approach to politics and to the role of being president.
I've heard several times in the recent weeks, and really more than that, I think, that the Jimmy Carter that you met when there was no spotlight was the same as the Jimmy Carter you saw when there was a spotlight on him. Is that accurate from your perspective?
Yes, absolutely. I'll give you a couple of examples. When he ran for president, we used to go down to Plains from Atlanta, a couple of staff members, in a one-engine plane. It could only hold three passengers. And we landed in a grass field in Plains with no control tower. And you knew you were at the end of the runway when the pine trees appeared. And I used to feel like kissing the ground every time. That's the shoestring we started with. It spent 100 days of his life in Iowa for the caucuses, which other candidates ignored. And that's the same Jimmy Carter I saw when he ran for governor. It's the same Jimmy Carter I saw when he ran for president. very approachable. And let me give, again, a couple of anecdotes. When I was domestic advisor in the White House, the president would allow his senior staff and family to go to Camp David for weekends occasionally. He knew that the toll of 24/7 days and nights away from our family, going to Camp David would give us a chance to reconnect. And he invited us not only, Mike, when he was there, but sometimes when he wasn't. And when he was there, again, my oldest son, Jay, was at that point about 10 years old. And he asked Jay if he would like to jog with him around Camp David. You can imagine the thrill of that. Hmm. He also invited my wife, now late wife Fran, and both boys over to his cabin to watch movies with he and the First Lady, with popcorn delivered. And that kind of common touch meant so much because he was an exacting taskmaster. He worked extremely long hours. He even would circle misspellings and split infinitives and grammatical mistakes in our memos. But he had a warm side to him as well.
I'm not sure if this is a strange question or even close to the mark, but I'm just wondering if being such a down-to-earth person who really aligned who he was with what he did may have made him a less effective politician at that level.
It's a really good question. And I think, to be very frank, that making the transition from the outsider, which is what the people wanted in the post-Watergate era, an outsider with a common touch, carried his own bags, talked about, I'll never lie to you, I want a government as good as people. Making the transition from that to the Oval Office, to the aura of the presidency, was not an easy transition. Example, for the first month, he insisted that the famous Hail to the Chief not be played when he entered a room in the White House. And I jokingly said to him, you know, we've spent 2 years trying to get here. It's no fun getting here and not being able to hear Hail to the Chief. And beside, people don't now expect you to be the common man. They want to look up to you as president.
Do you know if anyone ever referred to Jimmy Carter as Jim or James?
Certainly not to his face. but I will tell you a quick anecdote.
Yeah.
First day or two in the White House, I had a red phone, as did other of his senior aides, connected directly to the president. He called me up and said, Stu, it's Jimmy. And I said, no, it's not Jimmy. It's Mr. President. So he had to make that adjustment as well. And it was always Jimmy. That's his official name on his presidency.
That was Mike Canary speaking with Ambassador Stuart Eisenstadt. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Adrian Andrews, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Tom Bayless, Derek Hamm, and Mike Canary. And we're sending out a very public acknowledgement to the many, many contributions of WFSU News Director Lynn Hatter. She's essentially steered this ship of a program for just a handful of years shy of two decades. Lynn's being elevated to a much more responsible position within the WFSU family. We wish her nothing but success and fulfillment in the challenging years to come. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Evan Rossi, and I'm Tom Flanagan. We hope you'll join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.